Hello, regulars. You're listening to Floor by Floor, a Tower of God podcast discussing the latest chapters of the webtoon. I'm Virilene.
And I'm Reziat.
And we're your hosts. Welcome to the 15th floor, where we'll be discussing chapters 582 and 583, or Season 3, Episode 165 and 166. Let's start with Chapter 582 summary.
The chapter opens inside the Victor. Hugo comments on how odd it is to have Lobodon's huge fleet just stare at them. She wonders what they want since this isn't a strategic location. She doesn't know why they're there, but thinks Lobodon does. It doesn't matter to her, though. She's just excited to fight. She considers attacking first, since it feels like waiting is what they want. At the same time, Lobodon gets a call through his pocket and gets confirmation that Yasracha and Yama infiltrated the village. With Dawan's help, they also discover the location of the enemy's warp gate. With that done, Lobodon gives the orders to start. Kadidi and Catan fire their projectiles as Hugo watches, making a comment that it's nothing but a light mist. She orders the barriers to be set to visible just as the missiles make impact. We cut to Dawan at the warp gate. She hates working with the Lopobia army, but will destroy the gate if it means stopping a war that would sacrifice innocent lives. The gate shatters under a wave of flowers, and the Pobodao army is alerted. Lobodon orders his troops to hold a defensive line and not attack, even if the enemy attacks first. Kadidi is surprised because they have the upper hand but follows orders. Even if they stay on the fence, the tension will inevitably escalate and the beastkin will start to be sacrificed. Yama and Yasracha will need to hurry before that happens. We cut to that night in the village from the inn Yama and Yasracha are staying at. Yasracha points out that it seems Lobodon and the Victor are already facing off, so they should hurry. They enter the building where the book should be through a window, and Yama comments on how there's no security, almost like they want them to come in. Yasracha tells him not to be like that. As Yasracha is pointing out the way on the map, he senses that someone is in there and urges them to hurry. At the central door of the library, Giscard is testing a key on the door and is surprised when it opens. Yama and Yasracha sneak up behind him, but he evades their attacks and manages to put Shinsu handcuffs on both of them. Giscard smiles as he recognizes them as the two suspicious beastkin who entered town and asks if they came for the book. Yama threatens to throw Giscard as Yasracha wonders what the handcuffs are. Giscard calls them the Cuffs of Binding and the Key of Despair. Giscard then tells them that he doesn't know how they found out about the book, but wants them to stay tied up and out of his way while he retrieves the book for the family head. If they get in his way, he will kill them immediately. Yama protests and raises his hand, and Yasracha's bound hand gets pulled along. Giscard laughs and says that it looks like a leash, so maybe he should have put it around their necks. He then says the spell won't be released until one of them dies. His key could unlock them, but they won't be able to steal it from him. Yasracha calls his bluff, saying only a family head could place an indefinite spell. This must be temporary, although they don't know for how long. Giscard asks him how they found out about such a top secret that only the family head knew about until recently. Yama launches forward with an attack, and Giscard dodges and punches him brutally, continuing to ask how such pitiful creatures know about it. They continue to fight until Yama and Yasracha get tossed out of the way. Giscard says he'll leave figuring that out to the mothership. He's going to go grab his book. Yama's pissed, and he says he doesn't need to kill Yasracha in order to kill Giscard. Yasracha asks Yama if he remembers when they met at the wall. He still has the power to control Yama, but Yama would have to consent. Giscard enters the secret library, and in a glass case is the book they're looking for. Yama and Yasracha pop up behind Giscard and grab him by the back of his shirt. This time, their attacks are in sync, and they manage to beat on him until he drops the key. Yasracha unlocks Yama's cuff as Giscard gets up and laughs. They use the key of despair, while the actual key to unbind them is, and Giscard takes off his shirt to show them, embedded like a tattoo on his chest. The key they used is actually a weapon. As they argue over it, the cuff manifests into a needle and pierces Yasracha through the chest. And the chapter ends on that cliffhanger. Siyu has a great way of teasing us with these cliffhangers sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think we're going to get to find out what happens, not yet. So let's continue on to chapter 583 summary. We go back to Gustang, who gets a pocket call from Proust updating him that the mothership has almost arrived at its destination. Gustang says he's bought them time and asks how things are on the battlefield. Proust tells him that Lobodon took the bait and left the mothership. Kirin is leading all the branch family heads and is advancing. Gustang orders the Lopobia army be brought to the planned area and destroyed. He intends to dismantle the shield around Traumeray, knowing that he and Traumeray know that one day, those he loves will be the ones to betray him. He asks Proust about the book, and Proust tells him not to worry. They have the book bearer and their most trusted warrior in the family, Duma, on their side. The book shall be returned to him soon. At the front lines, the Popadel fleet prepares for battle. The second fleet captain, Popadel Luni, tells his team to not get worked up over the vanguard. They will defend and not expose their rankers for now. Kirin gets updated that the Popadel are attacking, and he orders the army to continue advancing. Once the battle starts, his ship will withdraw to the rear. The Chilly Windbear branch leader, Wee Wee, gets the same update and says either the Popadel are putting on a brave face or greatly underestimating them. As his people charge forward, the Popadel warp ship appears. Kirin gets notified, and he takes that as his cue to withdraw from the battle to go hunt their regular. The other family branch leaders are shocked to see him go. Suddenly, more Popadel ships start to warp in, including Proust, and they start to attack. Wee Wee calls it a trap and orders his troops to retreat. We go back a few hours ago to the docks inside the submarine. Karaka is talking to Jinsung via pocket. Jinsung says that he's escaped from the Lopobia mothership and plans to do so without Bomb noticing. Karaka tells him that they encountered the Lopobia army after warping, but it was Lobodon. He believes Lobodon has a thing that could turn the tide of the war, Popadel Gustang's weakness. Jinsung says he'll head over and request assistance from Fug as well. We cut to Bomb remembering what Laura said about Kirin, that he was the one leading the war and that they must go meet Lobodon in order to stop the war. His memory changes to him telling Kun and Rak that they must go to wherever Lobodon is in order to turn the tide of the war. Kun is suspicious and asks if Laura isn't conning him. Bomb isn't sure, but he felt like he could trust it. Kun says it's certainly a game changer if it's true, but they have two sets of eyes on them. Bomb says Miss Laura can keep Mr. Ababa quiet somehow. Kun says they can get to the gate with the warp ship, but they'll have to deal with two troublesome princesses. One princess to sneak them off to the warp ship by teleporting them, and one princess to tie down the one watching them. Since they're both on his side, they should ask them for help. Bomb calls in Dorsey, and she almost hangs up on him, but Kun cuts in to tell her that they have a plan that would put Liliel and Shiliel in her debt. And Dorsey is annoyed, but agrees to help. In the cafeteria, Yuri is chatting with Tiara and asks her why she thinks the Popadel family head thinks he can go against the other nine family heads by himself. Tiara says he would never start a war if he knew he was going to lose. Matt says he must have a plan. Yuri asks if they have an allied family, but Tiara doesn't know. Yuri laughs and calls it a cute bluff. Tiara tells her that if they keep going like that, one day it may be Jihad's army who will have no allies. Yuri isn't worried because she believes with just the princesses of Jihad, they can suppress all troops under the 10 families. Yuri is interrupted with a pocket message from Bomb. It's a very dramatic request to his most beloved Nuna to hold off the scary Popadel lady in order to go somewhere without anyone finding out. It's obviously scripted by Kun. She wonders what the brats are up to, but also wonders how to hold this monster of a woman without drawing suspicion. For Bomb, she comes up with a plan as she leaves her seat to retrieve a bottle of alcohol. We cut to Bong Bong dropping off the team at the warp ship bay. And Dorsey asks if the two bitches will owe her later, and Kun says he's sure dismissively. She doesn't quite trust him since he lies all the time. Kun tells Bong to get changed in the lighthouse since his clothes are too noticeable. And Dorsey asks to change also, and Rock wants to be included too. As they change, and Dorsey asks Bomb why he's trying so hard to intervene in the war instead of running away from it. Does he want to help the two princesses? He doesn't deny it, but he also feels like he needs to do something there. Fug wants to bind his fate to fighting the 10 families in Jihad, but it's his decision to follow that fate, and he doesn't want to run away. He believes this is tied to freedom for his friends, like in Dorsey. And Dorsey pops out of Kun's lighthouse in a sports bar just to tell Bomb, since when is he so grown up? With Dorsey and Bomb changed, but not Kun or Rock, they go to meet Lobodon. And that's the end of the chapter.
It certainly feels like we're on back-to-back setup chapters these last 2 weeks. Here's hoping for a payoff soon. The plot threads are beginning to cross over each other. So, about Yaman Yasracha, it's beginning to feel like they're just being thrown out here. As much as I would hate to see Yasracha die this way, he kind of needs to. Why drag this out so much? As controversial as it may sound, because I've grown to like him as a villain turned ally, and of course he's garnered a lot of sympathy for his past actions, I am of the belief that he likely should have died a long time ago. Like when Traumarized Warp Ship Donut broke up and ported everyone out. It would have been a shame, but right now, why is he still around plot-wise?
Maybe in the original draft he was supposed to die, and then CU revised it and was like, oh, but I still need this, and shoehorn him in there. It certainly feels a little odd, something like that.
And I'm worried because there's a lot of characters that have been kind of dragged out like this. And it just kind of feels like it cheapens their presence. Why introduce them and why kind of spend that screen time getting us to know them and then just kind of have them flounder a lot?
When there are so many other beloved characters that we want to see some screen time with.
Hopefully it's a temporary thing. But for now, I'm sincerely hoping that this is a death knell with a needle through the chest. Kind of an unimpactful death, but alas. If Siu pulls the whole, nah, he ain't actually dead card again, it'll really drive home the sensation that the deadly stakes established over the last 100 chapters are kind of pointless. Come on, Siu, do something. On the topic of those two, Kiskar definitely was some sort of key, or, well, has a key thing tattooed on him. Maybe he's some sort of skeleton key. I mean, it has some skeleton-like patterns. What else will he unlock? Yama going beast mode? Is he gonna trap Yasracha in him? I swear, if it goes in that direction. Either way, something I find interesting is Yasracha mentioning how only family heads are able to cast spells that have an indefinite time limit. So spells are supposed to wear off over time? Kind of brings into question the spell that Bomb may have placed on him by Arlene or whoever it was that placed it on him that allows him to break other spells because of its ranking being higher than other spells that he's encountered thus far. It's not going to wear off, is it? Does Bomb have a time limit? An expiration date? Should we shove him in the refrigerator? It feels like a throwaway line, but that has a lot of implications for the future.
CU is not one to just drop little bits of information like that and not use them again, so I think it'll come up again in the future.
And likely in some mind-blowing way, like a lot of the things have lately, especially with all the references to the Name Hunt Station and the Floor of Death and whatnot, which we haven't seen in literal years. But moving forward, our second chapter had a bit more meat and potatoes to it. Of course, just to get the elephant out of the room, the biggest takeaway here is Bomb. Wow. That'll keep a certain part of the fandom happy. It only took you 84 years, Siu.
We all kind of joked about it. We didn't think we were ever going to actually get it. Now the cat's out of the bag.
And people were loud about it. Let's just put it like that.
Yeah, now the next thing that they're shouting for is Kun. If we can get Bomb, how about Kun next?
We've gotten Rock, we've gotten Bomb now, but we haven't seen just once, but that was like a decade ago now.
He was a baby still.
Although there were many enjoyers of this particular development in the art, there was also a slight bit of criticism, and I kind of want to touch on this a bit. So, to comment on the art style, it certainly does feel far simpler than before. I know it's a point of contention for some people, but, well, regarding CU's health, we're all just going to have to settle for it. There's a few panels where it's distinct that CU lined the art himself, but they're becoming few and far between. He's stepped back a fair bit, and it's visible now. I just hope the plot makes up for this somewhat. I've mentioned before that it feels as though some of this arc has been hastily rewritten, and I think this chapter kind of exhibits that in certain places. I'm grateful for the little moments between the action, though, that we're getting as a result, because we're getting insight into everyone's thoughts, and that's incredibly important with all this action and rapid changes going on. I think we're fine, but there's a lot of people who are definitely blowing this particular chapter out of the water with criticism. And I don't think they're right, but everyone's entitled to their own opinions. As some of those people like to say, let the man cook.
For real, these changes were not made lightly. They're for Siu's health, and we just gotta deal with them.
But anyway, back to the plot. I'm glad to hear that Bomb really won't abide to anyone else's manipulation. That he's only doing this to get everyone's freedom. but it certainly seems like he's going to be railroaded into accomplishing what's been demanded of him, regardless of how much he might try to run from it. And this mature level of thinking is juxtaposed with his awkward and sunshiny attitude at key points. He's stuttering and unable to articulate his feelings into thoughts and words. And it cracks me up to have read that Kun wrote his text message to Yuri begging for help. We're back to scriptwriter, director, and producer Kun making things happen again.
I love that dynamic between them. I missed it.
And that's one of the reasons why I appreciate these setup chapters, because it allows for moments like these. Another thing that seems to be setting up in this chapter is what I believe to be Revolution's actual plot. Back on the battlefield, Prowse mentions to Gustong that the vice captain's plan is working, much to his chagrin. Vice captain of the Po Bidao, if I recall correctly, is Bellarir. So is Gustong currently being played by Revolution? Of course, this was hinted at earlier, what with their convenient introduction and all in the middle of this. So I wonder how exactly this is going to their plans. Maybe both books are bait. Maybe it's just to curry favor with Gustong. Maybe this is to send the flare signal to the other great families teetering on the fence to take action and take themselves out for Fug and other parties to sweep in and wipe the floor with Jihad, as Tiara hints.
It's really hard to tell who's besting who, who's going to win. There's so many plots trying to one-up each other.
It always feels like there's a puppet master manipulating the puppet master, manipulating the puppet master, and so on. Speaking of Tiara, Yuri is really going to try to play a drinking game with her? I commend her improvisation, but yeah, that's not going to work out.
I mean, is it not going to work out in that it's not going to work? Or is it not going to work out as in this is not going to end pretty? Because it seems like it's going to work. Tiara is too competitive to give that up.
But is she as bullheaded as a knock in that regard, where she won't turn down the challenge, period?
I guess we'll find out.
Either Yuri's going to get too drunk and not realize she's going to mess up. It's going to go too well and Tiara's going to get too drunk and not realize she messed up and Matt can't do anything. Or all three of them are just going to be drunk and inert. Well, I'm eagerly looking forward to what next week will bring us. It seems my guess that Kieran is going to intercept Bomb is likely to come to fruition. We shall see. Will Catman die? Will Lobodon intercept Kieran like that one meme of the people holding each other at gunpoint with a sniper at the second floor? Are the Lopobia branch leaders all about to go extinct? Find out next week in the next chapter of the Tower of Betrayals. Woo! So thank you so much for joining us, regulars. We'll see you on the next floor.
Goodbye.
Have a good one.